Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Stu.
We're Thrive Deeper and entering a new book of the Bible, Numbers, as we follow on from Leviticus.
Yeah, very much continuous.
I was going to say, very much continuous. And in this first section today, which we're going to cover from sort of chapters 1 through to 17, the end of 17, a lot of repetition again. Mm. And interestingly, true to its Greek name anyway, lots of numbers.
That's right, yeah.
So written approximately 1407 BC, but covers a period from sort of 1445 to 1407 BC. That's assuming the earlier Exodus dates. Mm. Unknown author, but attributed to Moses. And it really chronicles the journey of the Israelites from 2 years after the Exodus. From the foot of Sinai until they arrive at the Jordan River near Jericho, ready to enter the promised land. That's kind of the purpose of the book of Numbers. The Hebrew name for Numbers is actually Bemidbar, which is in the wilderness, which is probably a more accurate title
for the book of the Bible. Yeah. So it starts off with a chapter that is best understood in the light of all of the material on holiness and the emphasis on holiness in the book of Leviticus. So we have the census, title Numbers, comes about because of this census that's taken. And there's material here that basically you've got to picture this. It's about the arrangement of the tribes.
Yes.
I mean, this is interesting because, you know, you have the tribes arranged around the tabernacle. So the tabernacle's in the center. All this is very symbolic, Stu.
Yeah.
And so it's good to, I mean, even perhaps look up a picture or something of the tribal arrangement, because essentially what you see is a big cross. So they're arranged on each of the four sides,
yes,
with the tabernacle in the middle. But significantly, the Levites are encamped on the inside around the tabernacle. So there's a sense in which it's picturing this mediatorial role that the Levites have among the tribes of Israel. So they are there to guard the sacred precinct, as it were. So they're encamped immediately around it. Mm. And the other tribes are encamped, you know, on the four sides. I mean, this is interesting because you couldn't just set up your tent wherever you wanted.
No, that's right.
You know, like, you know, choose a spot and set up your tent. Now, every single time it's, you know, it was ordered in this cross formation. And, you know, if you climbed up on a mountain, you would have seen it.
But I think also the order reflects God's holiness. Things have to be done the right way at the right time by the right person, which we've seen all through Leviticus, and it's being carried on here now. God is a God of order, not a God of chaos. Yeah. Remember, right at the beginning, he switched chaos into order, and so he's continuing that with the way this is structured.
Yeah, that's right. So that's chapters 1 and 2. And then in chapter 3, the key idea is we move from that, the arrangement of the tribes around, so there's the numbering of the people, there's the arrangement of the tribes. Mm. Things are being put into order. We're still ordered. We haven't even left, actually.
No, that's right.
We haven't left Sinai.
Yeah.
Everything's being put in order. The lives of the people are being put in order. And now we've got the ordering of the camp, which is a symbolism of the ordering of their lives. Okay. Mm. And then as we go into chapter 3, we've got these instructions to the Levites to guard the holy precinct. Okay.
Yeah.
And also they are to be substitutes in a way because, you know, God claims the firstborn of the Israelites for himself.
Yes.
And in a sense, what they are, and this is, I think, significant, they are the subsistence. Firstborn, by the way, the significance in the ancient world of the firstborn is that they sort of stood as, in a sense, the kind of head of the family. You know, the family inheritance went to the firstborn, and the firstborn was the one who was charged with being the family head and, in a sense, that just clan head, you know, family head, clan heads were firstborn. The significance, of course, of God often choosing the youngest and not the firstborn. There's a bit of an inversion thing there, but that's another story. The point is here is that when God claims the firstborn, it's sort of a way of claiming all of the people, you're mine.
And therefore, everyone that follows from you is also mine.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone that follows from you. But the Levites, in a sense, while everyone is consecrated to be priests, the Levites, in a sense, stand in for the firstborn. They're a sort of substitute for the firstborn. And so they are the ones that function in the in the temple precinct. They're the ones that guard the temple precinct. But the importance of this, Stu, is that all of this is picturing something. Yes. This is all three-dimensional enacted theology, right? So this is ultimately picturing what God has in mind for God's people up in the future, which is that they would be, as it says in Exodus chapter 19, God says to his people, I've set you apart to be a holy nation and a kingdom of priests. And so this is pointing forward to the priesthood of all believers. But at this stage, and what we're explicitly told here is the Levites, in a sense, represent that role that's for everyone. So yeah. everyone is to be consecrated to this role at a future time. And that, of course, that time is now. Mm. And so we have the Levites kind of symbolizing here what actually our role is today.
But also the substitutionary principle as well, where the Levites replace the firstborn, the whole idea of the substitutionary sacrifice, in a sense, or the mediator between the people and God, which we of course see come in Jesus ultimately.
Yeah. And it points forward to essentially the life for life aspect of redemption. God comes to us in Jesus Christ. He gives his life for us so that we can give our lives to him. And so that idea of being completely consecrated to God, as indeed the Levites were, to be spread out among the people and to mediate the blessings of God to the people, this is a picture of the church in the nations.
Yes.
From chapter 4, we have a description of different responsibilities. So we're still along the theme of everything's being ordered here. Mm. And different Levite tribes have slightly different responsibilities. So, for example, the Kohathites have this responsibility of carrying the sacred things. Now, what would happen when they would break camp? All of the holy things, the Aaronic priests would wrap. So, for example, the Ark of the Covenant would be wrapped in the curtains of the tabernacle. All the sacred articles would be wrapped, everything inside, you know, the altar of showbread and the candlesticks and the altar of incense, they would all be wrapped in the curtains, which is interesting because the people would never see these things.
No.
This idea that, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, you know, that would have been visible. It was never really visible. It was always wrapped and, you know, it was carried
in the wrapping.
And it had to be carried on the shoulder of the Kohathites is the point here. Mm. So they're set aside for this, which you can see the issue then with the story about how David brought the ark up to Jerusalem and Uzziah touched the ark. The issue there is that there's an act of desecration. I mean, they were not treating the ark. It just put it on an ox cart. It's meant to be carried on the shoulder of the Kohathites.
Again,
that was a big issue.
Right? Sacred responsibility. Yeah. God's order, you know, is about the right person, the right time, and then the right way. It follows through again.
Even of the Kohathites, it says, but they must not touch the holy things or they will die, right? Yeah. And that's what you see in that story about David bringing the ark up. And then you've got the different responsibilities for the Gershonites and the Merarites. So Gershonites were responsible for dismantling and reassembling the various curtains of the tabernacle and tent, and the Merarites, the framing structures and so forth. There's really ordering responsibilities here.
And very
much, you do the curtains, totally. You do the frames.
And it's very much like we all have a role within the church today.
It is.
There are things we each have to do, and no responsibility is more important than any other. It's a different task, a different role.
Yeah. And then there's this emphasis on the purity in the camp. Mm. It talks about sending out the unclean and making restitution for wrongs. And this is both ways of ensuring the purity of the camp.
And recognizing that holiness is communal. So sin contaminates the whole camp. It's not just one person.
Yeah, that's right.
And we see this as we go forward from here in the section we're looking at today, very unfortunately often, where the sin of one contaminates the whole camp.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And again, the principles still apply here. There's a sense we as the church are God's people and we are sacred space. And I think there's so much we can learn from this about honoring sacred space and, you know, ensuring that we're honoring God by what we do and how we treat each other. And the sin of one is, in a sense, the sin of the many as well. It's not, we tend to individualize that. There's a really interesting and perhaps, Stu, for some perplexing section in chapter 5. It's a test for an unfaithful wife. Mm. And it's in situations where a husband suspects his wife of unfaithfulness. It sounds a little bit like trial by ordeal.
Yes.
You know, trial by ordeal is when kind of throw them into a river and if they drown, you
know. A witch thing, isn't it? Yeah, they float, they're a witch, and if they sink, they're not, or something, right?
Now, trials by ordeal were actually quite common in the ancient world, and often situations like this were tested by ordeal. This actually is different, Stu, because... And I think this is the thing to understand about this, because it sounds like a trial by ordeal. So basically the idea is that she's to be brought in. She's to declare on oath if she's claiming innocence.
Yes.
Which in this case she will be. Yes. Right. This is the, you know, where she's suspected by the husband, but she's claiming innocence. So this is actually a law that protects her.
Yes, it is.
This is the important thing, because the trials by ordeal was sort of rigged. It was a guilty until proven innocent sort of thing. And so because of how common they were, this is providing something that in some ways is intelligible to ancient people. Remember, you know, God's taking things a big step forward here, but it has to still work in that context, right? To a people that are used to a certain way of dealing with things.
Yeah.
So in a sense, what God is doing is protecting the woman. And so what she does is that she comes into the sanctuary. She declares on oath that she's innocent. And then she drinks some water with a bit of sprinkling of dust from the sanctuary floor, so sacred space in it. And the idea is, because she's declared an oath, that if she's lied, that there's been a desecration of sacred space.
Yeah.
And the drinking of the water with the holy dust in it is to cause a bloating of the stomach. Actually doesn't say it. She dies from it. So it's more to do with probably her fertility, or, you know, it's kind of a bringing a curse upon herself by lying in the sacred precinct.
Mm.
This is remarkable for what it's preventing.
Yes, in the culture of the time.
In the culture of the time.
And yeah.
So I know it's weird for us. I know it's really strange. But, you know, when this was first, if it was read out or whatever at the time, people would have thought, gee, she gets off really light.
You know. Well, and I think also for me, two things that stood out from this particular thing, because it is initially you kind of go, and then if you realize, as you said, that it's about protecting her, but it's also about repairing relationships, because the man and the wife can then go away.
That's
with
right.
Trust.
Yeah.
Which before there would just be ongoing suspicion.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just going to break that relationship anyway. So there's an opportunity here to actually draw a solid line and say, she's innocent, and before God, she's innocent, and the relationship can be repaired.
Again, it's in a way that's intelligible to them, to him, to the man. Okay, so we've done something that slightly evokes the trial by ordeal, but in a sense, it also abolishes that, but still satisfies this sense. Okay, she is declared on oath in the holy place, you know, and the physical gesture, I think, is probably the closest link with the trial by ordeal.
Yes.
But the idea is that, you know, it's not going to harm her, in a natural sense, harm her, unless she has actually lied in the presence of God. And that's a serious, a very serious thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's got to go away satisfied by that.
And which case that means that they can move forward in their relationship without that suspicion hanging. Yeah. The other thing, Matt, just really quickly, is I think it also reminds us, but also the people at the time, that God knows hidden things. God knows whether she's guilty or not.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And so it kind of a message to the rest of the people, don't think that I won't see the things that you do in secret.
Yeah, that's right. So in chapter 6, so we've talked about, you know, the rules for the Levites and the holiness of, you know, dealing with holiness, dealing with this, what would have been quite a common relational issue in a very close-knit society.
Yes.
Now there's a provision made for non-Levites who nevertheless want to dedicate themselves
to serving the Lord.
To serving the Lord. So there's a provision for that too. Okay, so if you feel like, well, hey, you know, I'm not a Levite, but I want to express my devotion to God, there's a way of doing this, and this is with this thing called the Nazirite vow. Now the interesting thing about this, it almost seems when it's introduced, it's as though it's something that's already a practice that's already somewhat familiar. The idea of people dedicating themselves somewhat familiar to the people. And probably in a cultural context, there was this idea is somewhat, is perhaps somewhat familiar, people dedicating themselves. So he says, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a dedication to the Lord as a Nazirite, right? So it's almost as though the Nazirite thing is already somewhat familiar to them.
But also the interesting thing to me is man or woman.
Yeah.
Typically in this culture, that sort of thing was just for the men. But here, this is open to anyone, man or woman,
Who
wants to pursue deeper consecration in God's purposes. You know?
That's right. And so in a sense, what God is doing is putting a stamp of saying, yes, I'm going to make a way that a man or a woman can do that if they want, but it's got to be by my pattern. Right, yes. It's not just don't just follow
make up your
pagan
own rules.
Patterns or make up your own rules, because that's not, you know, that's not going to count. So they must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, not even vinegar made from wine. Any fermented drink is out of the question. I remember the priests, before they serve in the tabernacle, before they go about their official service, they also are to abstain from fermented drink beforehand. You know, that's probably because, you know, of intoxicating effect. I mean, there's a few reasons probably for this. It's also perhaps associated with, I mean, there's a sense of self-denial here because of the luxury of wine and so forth. But it's also perhaps an association with the settled life of abundance in the land and almost a sort of dedication to the kind of life in the desert, sort of, that there could be some.
There's going to be sacrifices, in a sense.
It's a form of self-denial as well, because it also says they must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. Mm. So there's some association with grapes and the settled state in the land. It's almost a little bit like when, you know, the monastic communities began after the Constantinian era, you know, when Christianity was legalized, and they felt that
made it all a bit too easy.
It made it all a bit too easy. And so people wanted to actually live lives of self-denial, evoking the time when they were under persecution.
To keep their faith strong, probably.
To keep their faith strong and to ensure that the cost of discipleship was retained. Mm. So in a way, it's a little bit like that.
So not allowed to cut their hair.
That's right.
A whole heap of other rituals and requirements to be under a Nazarite. So.
Yeah, that's right. This is probably, so Samson, Samson was under a Nazarite vow. He was dedicated from birth, which is a slight deviation from this, because this is provided for people who want to set themselves apart for God. In the case of Samson, it's actually God who says he must be set aside from birth as a Nazarite. Now, that's to evoke, because Samson is becomes a sort of a symbol or is a kind of what I would describe as an archetypal individual. He is a symbol of rebellious Israel. And I emphasize rebellious Israel, because if you know the story of Samson, he's not a good guy, right? But he's dedicated from birth to God, and yet he's very rebellious. And that is what Israel was. So the Nazarite vow is used in that way. Samuel as well, probably. That's probably a Nazarite. He was probably dedicated as a Nazarite. Some have suggested perhaps John the Baptist.
Okay, because they didn't have their haircut or?
Well, he lives in the desert.
Yes,
there's a few things, but it's not totally sure about that, but certainly Samson and probably Samuel there. So at the end of this, we have this priestly blessing. This is the climax of everything that's set up in the first six chapters, okay? And it echoes the trajectory and the climax of Leviticus 1-9, when Moses and Aaron went into the temple into the tabernacle, came out and they blessed the people. Well, you know, Numbers, you get the same sort of thing. All of these rules around that's, you know, symbolizing the holiness and the ordering of the camp and the, you know, purity laws and all of that. And then all of that culminates in this famous priestly blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. And so God says, so they will put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them. And I think the importance of this is that as God's people, this is the vocation of God's people. And this is what the Levites are symbolizing in a very special sense, but what is ultimately the vocation of all God's people, and that is to carry the name of God. We carry the name of God. Now, this is also something that's said about the temple when Solomon builds the temple, and God says to Solomon, I will put my name there. That's what he says. Mm. So it's a clear connection, clearly evoking this idea and symbolizing what ultimately God's people are, temples of the Holy Spirit, or together a temple of the Holy Spirit, where God puts his name. And so it's the place to which God's blessing flows and from which blessing flows. So this is the idea of God says to Abraham, I will bless you and you will be a blessing, and through you all the ends of the earth will be blessed in Genesis 12, 2-3. Mm. So that's what's happening here. This is God's name being blessed. God's name is being put on them and he's going to bless them to be a blessing. That's where we get to at that climactic point. Then there's the response of the people. And in chapter 7 talks about offerings that the people bring to the tabernacle in response to everything.
And all of those offerings are the same. You know, there's equality before God. No tribe is privileged above another, obviously. Generosity is modeled here as a form of worship, giving as an act of devotion to God. And God's presence, you know, Moses hears God's voice from the mercy seat. Intimacy and revelation, again, continues to flow to the people through Moses from God. And we see that through that. Chapter 7 there.
Yeah, that's right. So then there's an implementation of this. So the Levites, and I realize if you're reading through this, look, again, I realize it can be hard going. Okay, persevere with it. You know, I just think it's great to read with a highlighter or something and do something active as you read that. I do recommend that. You know, what are the things that jump out? What are the things that feel like they connect and that are relevant for now? Because remember, you know, the Levites are a symbol of something that we're meant to be. So this is relevant to us.
Yes.
But of course, we've got to understand the symbolism and so forth. So you get the Levites are set apart. And then in chapter 9, they celebrate the Passover. This is, of course...
Now, that's the first time they've celebrated the Passover since the Exodus, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So this is... Yep, that's right. This is the first time. So it's the second Passover celebration, essentially.
Yeah.
The first one was the real deal.
Thing. Yep.
Yeah. And this every subsequent one is a remembrance festival. So this is how they start. You know, it's kind of starting again. We're about to move out, but we're going to celebrate the Passover, which reminds us of who we are.
And it kind of sets their roots in redemption, in God's redemption, really, doesn't it? Because it reminds them... Hey, we're only here because God has brought us out of captivity.
Yeah.
Of course, they forget that soon.
That's
enough,
right.
But anyway.
Yeah. And then because we're now about to read about how they set out, you've got this description, the longest description of the role of the cloud, the pillar of cloud and fire, which is a symbol of God's presence.
Yeah.
You've got this longest description of how this works. This section, Stu, has got a certain rhythm to it. So it says from verse 15, on the day the tabernacle, the tent of the covenant law was set up, the cloud covered it from evening till morning. The cloud above the tabernacle looked like fire. This is how it continued to be. The cloud covered it, and at night it looked like fire. And that's the repetition there. And you have this throughout this. Whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent, the Israelites set out. Whenever the cloud settled, the Israelites encamped. At the Lord's command, the Israelites set out. At his command, they encamped. As long as the cloud stayed over the tabernacle, they remained in the camp. When the cloud remained over the tabernacle a long time, the Israelites obeyed the Lord's order and did not set out. Sometimes the cloud was over the tabernacle only a few days. At the Lord's command, they would encamp. And then at his command, they were set out. And it goes on and on like this. So, you know, when the Lord moved, they moved. When the Lord stayed, they stayed. This repetition actually is very artful because the text almost gives us a kind of rhythm. You know, this is their rhythm of life now.
Yeah.
You know, when the cloud lifted, they would break camp and they would move. When the cloud settled, they would settle. So this is the rhythm of their lives. And of course, when the cloud moved, there was the trumpets were blown. This is what is described in chapter 10. And they would know that they needed to move.
And the cloud moves unpredictably, you know, as that indicates. They didn't know. So the people had to trust.
Yeah, that's right.
When suddenly it's like, we've only been here 2 days and we're packing up and moving again.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, can't we just stay a few more days? No, when God's ready to move, we need to be ready to move. And I think it was, in fact, you wrote it, and I think the Thrive Bible Reading Guide, the fact that sometimes we feel distant from God and it's because he's moved and we haven't followed.
Yeah.
Or we've moved and he's still waiting.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So I think really important thing to understand, or importance of the value of understanding God's guidance here. They had to trust God.
Yeah. And we've got to remember too, the significance of these stories. Let's just, the big picture here is that all of this is providing a picture for us of how the life in God works.
Yes.
Israel in this circumstance are, and you know, it's described elsewhere in the scriptures, this idea of Israel as a sign that they embody a certain prophetic message to us. And so these stories and this situation with the tabernacle, and this is not just for them, this is actually saying something even to us now about how this works.
Totally.
Because, of course, the pillar of cloud and fire is a symbol of the Holy Spirit who dwells in our hearts. And we're told, and in fact, the language that Paul uses in, for example, in Galatians chapter 5, when he talks about keeping in step with the Spirit, is very much evoking this idea of the pillar of cloud. So finally,
trumpets,
Stu,
you mentioned the trumpets. We don't need
finally,
to...
Stu, we're leaving. We're leaving Mount Sinai in chapter 10 from verse 11. On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of the covenant law. Then the Israelites set out from the Sinai desert, and they traveled from place to place until the cloud came to rest in the desert of Paran. So it's got this description of how all the tribes move and how they set out. In verse 33, it says, they set out from the mountain of the Lord and they traveled for 3 days. The Ark of the Covenant went before them during those 3 days to find them a place to rest. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day and they set out from the camp. So whenever the Ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you." It's a section actually of Psalm 68. Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." It's a beautiful, you know, a statement of, I mean, they're moving into unknown territory with God only knows who's there. And so there's this prayer, "Lord, protect us," you know, as we go out, and then, "Lord, return and be in our midst as we settle."
And the intertwining of sort of worship and warfare there, because it's like worshiping God and following God, but also dealing with whatever they come across along the way.
Now, there's a transition here. Okay. So far, you know, we're told everything's set up, the order is established, they're to follow the cloud, all the instructions are given, all the law is given. Right. Now they're off. Now let's see how you go with living life this way. Let's see how you go trusting in God. Like you just said, we're following the cloud. Are we willing to trust? They're still being fed from the manna. How are we going to go with this? Well, famously, this very period that we're about to enter into, it's a real struggle for these people. Yeah.
It's a bit of a tragic turning point.
And really, when I say it's a struggle, the text doesn't portray it as necessarily like it's hard. I mean, they have seen God do
amazing things,
incredible things, right? So this makes them accountable, right? They've seen amazing things. They've received amazing provision. They've seen everything that they would need, including protection from enemies, you know, when they were attacked by the Amalekites. And I mean, they've seen God provide.
And God even says this, you know, "These people who I've done so many wonders amongst," and they still.
So hence we come to this cycle of grumbling, the grumbling of the people in the desert, you know, "Oh, we're all going to die. We haven't got enough. We're going to," I mean, it's this constant thing that happens again and again. And I just want to point to the pattern here, Stu, because what often happens, and the cycle is important. This is where it's important just to step back from the text and to see that this thing happens again and again. But there are elements of this pattern that are very important. So the people refuse to trust. They grumble against God. They dishonor God in doing that. They dishonor God's leaders as well. And so there are consequences. This is a very, very serious thing. And there's always some indication that this is a serious thing. It's not a small thing. And the initial judgment that they suffer threatens the people as a whole. I mean, at every case, it looks like, I mean, whether all grumbled or whether it was a representative few or whatever, the whole group is in danger, essentially of extinction.
Yeah.
And there are moments where God says to Moses, "That's it.
I'm done.
I'm done with this people. You know, you and your family, let's go. I'll start again with you." And this is where the pattern is important, because again and again, what we see is Moses step in, sometimes in a state of exasperation. I mean, but Moses steps in and he says, no, "Lord, you have saved this people. Just what will the nation say when they hear that you have done this to your own people?" And he intercedes.
Yeah.
But this is very, very important. We're meant to see here that this role of intercession, that this ends up saving a people, that intercession brings salvation for a people who deserve judgment.
Yes.
Intercession becomes the key. Now, what is the key role of the priests? What is the key role that we have? The initial key role, right, is that of intercessors. This is how, in a sense, the mission of the church, because we think about perhaps primarily sharing the message and inviting people to join us. No, actually, the initial mission is one of prayer. We conduct that in prayer. It is the act of intercession, praying for God's blessing, which is the significance of the priest declaring the blessing.
We look over the people.
Yeah, yeah. I read that beautiful blessing. Essentially, what Moses is doing here is standing between God and the people and saying, "Lord, for your name's sake, I know this people deserve judgment, but bless them instead." And God is all too pleased to do that. But he wants to do it through the act of intercession.
Right.
So the role of intercession is a way of being Like, God does want to forgive, but he wants to forgive through, you know, through this act of intercession, essentially. And of course, this ultimately, it's a representation of the intercession of Christ, who, as the book of Hebrews says, always lives to intercede for us at the right hand of God the Father. But we too, as I said, this intercessory role is a vital part of what it means to be a kingdom of priests. So that's a very important theme in the book of Numbers. So it says in chapter 11 that they complained about their hardships. Mm. You get this taste of judgment, right? Not complete judgment, but this taste of judgment, fire from the Lord burnt among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord and the fire died down. So that place was called Tabernacle because the fire of the Lord had burnt among them. Okay. Verse 4, the rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing. So you get this, cycle happening. It says in verse 10, you know, the Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on yourself? What have I done to displease you that you put, you know, put the burden of these people upon me?"
We've all probably felt like that. Any of us that have been in leadership positions at times,
and you know, it's and this is interesting because you know, the first time Moses intercedes from the people, but you know, like this is a legitimate prayer as well.
Totally,
Lord, I need help here.
Yeah.
He's not saying destroy the people. He's just saying this is too much for me. Again, similar to in chapter 18 of Exodus, when God raises up other leaders to support Moses.
Yeah.
In the same way.
He does it again.
He does it again. Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you. Mm. And he says, I will take some of the power of the Spirit that is on you and put it on them. Mm. They will share the burden of the people with you. Essentially God answers his prayer though. So instead of destroying the people, he tells the people to consecrate themselves in preparation for something that he's going to do. Mm. And again, he sends them quail. Mm. But he says, right, but there's still an element of judgment here because I'm going to stuff you with stuff until you're sick of it.
That's right. But there'll be discipline with it as well. Exactly. Yeah. And I think important there to recognize that ingratitude is also rebellion. I don't think we recognize it. Not being thankful for what we have, desiring what we don't have instead of being thankful for what we do have is actually rebellion against God. He's given us what we need.
Yeah.
And that's an important principle here.
Yeah, that's right. So this happens there, that they receive this quail. Also, before that happens, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon these 70 elders. And it's interestingly, it says they prophesied, but they did not do so again. So there was something
in that moment.
Is this some kind of ecstatic speech or is this kind of sort of speaking in tongues or something like that? We actually don't know, but the point is it was evident to everyone that they had received the Spirit of God. That's the cycle that we see. So you get it again in chapter 12 when
Miriam and Aaron rebel.
You know, Miriam and Aaron now. I mean, this is, man, can you imagine how tough this is for Moses? Because now it's not only just the people, but Miriam and Aaron oppose essentially, this is a bit of a power struggle, says Miriam. Aaron began to talk against Moses. Interestingly here, because of his Cushite wife, now we're not actually completely sure, is this a reference to Zipporah? Well, she can't really qualify as a Cushite.
Which is an Ethiopian.
Yeah, which is Ethiopian. So it may be that she's passed away and perhaps he's married. And unless this is a second wife, you know, at the same time. But I think most probably what's happened here is that Zipporah has passed away and he's married this other woman. We just haven't heard about it in the story. He's married a Cushite. Perhaps they've got a problem with him marrying this foreigner. That's the pretext, at least. That's not the main reason.
No,
the main reason
is
this is a power struggle. Now, it says in verse 3, now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. And perhaps his humility, he's not that strong kind of pharaonic kind of leader. You know, he's a humble guy and they're taking advantage of this.
It's opportunistic, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So the Lord comes down in the pillar of cloud, we're told. And
there's
basically
a bit of a mediation with the
There's
thread.
A bit of a mediation, that's right, yeah. And actually, it's interesting because it says that Miriam's skin was leprous. It became as white as snow.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a, you know, perhaps that relates to the original complaint because, of course, Moses Cushite's wife would have been black. You know, and so that there is, you know, perhaps this, you know.
This contrast.
This contrast here. Perhaps, you know, that's been suggested by commentators. But, you know, her skin becomes leprous, but she is only healed. And here it is again, Stu. Mm. She is healed only when Moses intercedes for her.
Yes.
I think it's very significant that this is the way that God wants to do it, because this is a way is that you need to honor this guy because of him that you're all surviving in the first place, right?
Yeah. Because of his obedience, exactly. Not because he's necessarily bold and, as you said before, but because he's just obedient.
Yeah, that's right. You know? So now we come to a very famous story. And again, remember, we're in this cycling of grumbling and rebellion. Okay, this is still part of this cycle. That, by the way, is remembered from here on as this.
Yes.
You know, the Israelites tempting God in the desert and rebelling against God in the desert. It's this infamous period of time. Well, probably this is perhaps one of the most significant parts of this cycle, because Moses sends 12 representatives of the tribe to go and explore the land. They go and explore the land and they come back and they report it is actually as good as God promised that it would be.
Right? And they bring some fruit back with them.
That's right. Mm. So it's quite a long journey. I mean,
yes, it is a long journey, right? Pretty much from the bottom to the top of modern day Israel, really.
That's right. Yeah. So they go throughout the land. They bring back the
takes them 40 days, which is important later. Yep.
That's right. They report that, as I said, God wasn't lying to us. It actually is as good. But, and this is the key, it says,
we can't, in verse 31, we can't go up against the people because they are stronger than we are. So they gave a negative report to the Israelites about the land they had scouted. The land we pass through to explore is the one that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are men of great size. We even saw the Nephilim there. The offspring of Anak were descended from the Nephilim. Yeah. To ourselves, we seemed like grasshoppers, and we must have seemed the same to them.
Yeah, now you need to remember this, because the person who's going to complete the conquest is David. David is the one that completes the conquest. Mm. And the first thing that he does is stand up against a giant, right? So that's the evoking this Nephilim thing. Mm. Now, of course, the Nephilim, we've spoken about this before, and we won't go into here, but they were believed to be a kind of hybrid.
Descendants.
You know, and it seems from Genesis chapter 6 that there's this kind of hybrid thing that happens between demonic beings and, you know, sort of demonic human thing. And it doesn't necessarily say here that they were. It's just that they believe them to be.
They saw it that way.
Yeah, that's how they saw it. And so the people raise a cry and they weep. We're all done. What did you bring us here for? Just to destroy us? I mean, this is terrible, Stu. Like, it's just terrible. Yep. God has fulfilled all of his promises.
And they've seen him do it time and time again.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, famously, Caleb and Joshua are the only ones that say, no, come on, guys, we can do this.
Yes.
You know, God has brought us this far and he will lead us in.
Yeah. But interestingly, they don't say, well, no, that's not true. They were all short people and we felt like giants
to them. Right.
Basically, they're saying our faith in God's promise to us is going to rise up against what we see in our eyes, the fear that we may have seen with our eyes. So it's not like they looked at a different area and it was different. They saw the same thing, but they knew who God was.
Yeah.
And they decided to lean on their faith rather than their fear.
So the people are freaking out and rebelling and saying terrible things. You know, God has brought us out to destroy us and all of this sort of thing. And and they're pleading with the people. And then there's this other moment, and again, here is the cycle, Stu, where the Lord said to Moses, this is verse 11 of chapter 14, the Lord said to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the signs I've performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a great nation, stronger than they. Mm. Then verse 13, Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They've also heard that you, Lord, are with these people, and you, Lord, have been seen face to face, that your cloud stays. So he's pleading, Lord, it's essentially what he's saying is, for the sake of your glory
and your reputation,
Lord, and your reputation among the nations. This is a strong appeal. It's doing essentially what John Bunyan in his book on prayer referred to as arguing before the throne of grace, right? Yeah. And there's this boldness that Moses has, and it's all in the light of the fact that God had bound himself to his people by a covenant. And Moses here is, and again, to emphasize, he is a model of what intercession is, right? God is saying, I'm going to destroy these people. Moses says, no, for your sake of your glory, show mercy. And then the Lord says, very well, I will do that. Mm. And it's this amazing pattern of intercession. Verse 19, the climax of the prayer, in accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now. There's an appeal to precedent. You've forgiven them again and again and again. Lord, now forgive them once more, right?
Which he says earlier in verse 17. So now may my Lord's power be magnified just as you have spoken. The Lord is slow to anger and rich in faithful
love. Yeah, he appeals to God's revelation of himself.
Yeah, forgiving wrongdoing and rebellion. Yeah.
That's right. It's like a, you know, a defense lawyer in a, but he knows that they're guilty. He's not denying that they're guilty, but he's appealing to God's mercy. Powerful, powerful example of intercession. And it's something you see right through the Psalms, this sort of model of arguing before the throne of grace, appealing to God's promises. Very, very powerful.
And then, of course, there's about 40 verses of God deciding whether he will or whether he won't and making all these requirements on people and all those sorts of things.
Well, he says in verse 20, the Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you asked.
And my point exactly. There's all of this intercession, but God is so quick to want to forgive and restore and bring people into a right relationship. But there are still consequences. And there are still discipline that's going to follow.
So they're forgiven, but they're consequences. This is important to remember. So because they refuse to go into the land, the Lord says, all right, that's fine. You refuse to go into the land. You'll wander in the desert the rest of your life.
Yeah, none of you will get it.
Now, what we see is that God is still with them.
Yes.
But they wander in the desert because they refuse to go into the land. Now, the people raise an outcry and they kind of regret that. And they actually try. It's, you know, it's
we were wrong. Crazy.
We
Let's
were wrong.
Have
and
a
they try
chance.
To they try to go in. And God says, No, I'm not. That's it. Like, I've told you, you're going to wander in the desert. That's what's going to happen. So they actually give it a go. They go in and they get defeated. And so then it's interesting, Stu, after this, we have this chapter on offerings. I mean, it's primarily about different kinds of sacrifices. This is a kind of moment of calm. In a way, it's like the eye of the hurricane, as one commentator said. After this dramatic narrative of the previous chapter, you know, you get this ritual sort of legislation. But this is important to you because it's a sign that God is still going to deal with them.
He's not finished with them yet.
I'm not finished with you.
Totally.
So, we're going to continue. He's continuing to invite them to gestures of worship.
Yes.
I mean, that's, I think, what's remarkable about chapter 15 in its
And, of
context.
Course, that's when he introduces the tassels as reminders, physical symbols that help shape spiritual obedience to remind them, hey, this is just to remind you where we've been, what's happened, and that I'm with you, but it
I'm
requires
still
obedience.
With you. Yeah. And then, Stu, from this time on, they're angelic, aren't they?
They of course
just
they
obey
are.
The Lord unconditionally.
Well, we learned our lesson.
You know, 100 times we've... Of course. Now we come to the famous chapter that describes Korah's rebellion. Mm. Now, Korah was a Kohathite. So very significant responsibility the Kohathites had. And there's these Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram. Anyway, they basically rebel against the authority of Moses and Aaron. I mean, it's another power struggle. You know, they're saying, everyone's holy. Why are you special? What, you know, well, it's clearly God had set them apart and given them these roles. So this is rebelling against God's order, you know, that he set up in the community.
Yeah.
And, you know, here again, I mean, Moses falls face down before God.
But he's kind of a bit more frustrated at this point. He's kind of going, okay, let's just get this settled once and for all. I'm sort of tired of dealing with you as well. And I think we see the rebellion against God's leaders, God's appointed leaders, is actually rebellion against God.
Yeah.
And we need to be reminded of that. And that holiness is not democratic. It's God who chooses who his
priests
will be.
Yeah. So basically what happens is that, again, this is the same cycle. So again, the Lord says, they come out, you know, they're to stand in front of their tents. And it says in verse 20, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, separate yourself from this assembly so I can put an end to them at once. Okay. So here it is again, Stu. Mm. Yet again, notice the pattern. Verse 22, but Moses and Aaron fell face down and cried out, O God, the God who gives breath to all living things, will you be angry with the entire assembly when only one man sins?
Yep.
Now, God is just to do this, right? Because no one's really any better than anyone else at this stage. Now, it's also,
Remember the whole community came out and complained.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
41. It's not just a couple of them came up, it's the whole community came out and started complaining. It's like a few people whipped up the crowd against the leaders, and then everyone comes out against them. So,
that's right.
Absolutely.
But they were ringleaders. And
so,
again, God answers their prayer. He doesn't destroy the entire assembly. Mm. Notice it's Moses and Aaron who offer this prayer this time.
Yes.
Because this is Aaron's role as well. So, he's getting the idea, getting this intercessory idea. Then God says, okay, so step away from the tents of the ringleaders. And then verse 31, as soon as he finished saying all this, the ground under them split apart, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households and all those associated with Korah together with their possessions. Now, we know from the genealogies that there was a survivor of the clans of Korah, and the descendants that became known as the sons of Korah became musicians in the temple. So there's a story of grace there as well.
But Aaron stops the plague because God says, because of this, there's going to be a plague, because all the other people were complaining as well. So he destroys Korah and his clan.
Yeah.
The rest of the people aren't going to get off lightly either. So there's going to be a plague. And Aaron, again, through intercession, prays and stands between the living and the dead,
The
word says, you know. And again,
And that's because after the reason, because the threat to the whole people again there is that when this happens to Korah, the community grumbles again.
Yes.
Look what you've done. You've
destroyed
God's people
and
now we're all going to they just cannot, resist just complaining and complaining and complaining. And so, again, there's an extension of that, because what Aaron is to do is to take a censer, put incense in it.
Yes.
And to make atonement for them. You know, so again, we're getting just a little bit more detail about that intercession is possible because this provision for atonement has actually been made. So in order to apply the provision for atonement, intercession is part of that. Again, important link to the fact that Christ provides a sacrifice for us, but he also provides this intercessory role for us. He pleads with us at the right hand of God the Father.
And then as we finish with chapter 17, we see God reaffirming who the leaders are, with Aaron's staff.
Yeah.
God confirms Aaron's priesthood through a miraculous sign, basically.
And it's basically the staff essentially sort of stands for the candlesticks the candlesticks in the tabernacle were like almond trees.
Yeah, right.
So they were shaped with the arms that they were meant to kind of almond trees. And so there's a sort of a connection with, the sprouting, and not only sprouting, but blossoming and producing almonds.
Yeah. Yes. Remarkable. Yeah. I mean, this dead piece of wood. And, again, life from death. God's symbolic, really probably of divine election.
Right? Yeah, that's right. And so it's a dead staff is becoming fruitful.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a bit of a prophetic sign as well. You know, God is going to bring about fruit from a dead looking branch here.
From dry bones.
Yeah, from dry bones. He's going to bring life. And so there's a prophetic element to that too. In chapter 18, to finish, Stu, there's again a reminder of the duties of the priests and Levites.
Yep.
This is important in its context because God says, I am these. The fact that it's these people, Aaron's authority has been demonstrated.
Yes.
And now God is again giving these instructions to the priests and Levites and reminding them of their responsibility, not just their role, but their responsibility. So, yes, I've set you apart.
Mm.
Okay. And all of this has been authenticated. The people have been reminded, but just remember your responsibility here. It's a high responsibility.
Yeah, you bear the iniquity of the sanctuary. That you've got to protect.
That's right.
But I think the other thing that really through chapter 18 stood out to me too is that holiness isn't just about being spiritual. There's structure. There's order.
Yeah.
And God's holiness requires order and structure. Yeah.
And it's interesting too that there are these instructions that when they enter into the land, that they don't get an inheritance of their own.
Mm.
They are to be spread among the people. And significantly, God says, I myself am your inheritance.
Yeah.
Right? So there's provisions made for them, and the tithes are to maintain, the worship services, essentially. And so they are provided for, but there's this, beautiful demonstration of, again, and I think prophetically looking forward to this idea of Christians as a kingdom of priests spread out among the nations with God himself as our inheritance through Christ.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.